It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
My name is Cerise Castle. I am a freelance journalist based in Los Angeles, and I wrote the first ever history of gangs inside the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department.
Let me just ask, like, what pushed you to write that?
Well, I grew up here in Los Angeles, in the LA area, and my entire life, I grew up hearing things about gangs in the LA County Sheriff's Department. I heard things from friends of mine. I heard things from teachers. I heard things from my mother, from my older brother. And it always fascinated me. I think a good reason why I was so intrigued was because, you know, I had some interactions with law enforcement as a youth, whether that be sheriff's deputies coming in and doing DARE presentations to my school. I had some interaction with the foster care system. So in that way, it was always just sort of confusing to me that the people that were encouraging me to not try drugs, to stay away from gangs, were actually involved in gangs themselves. I knew, you know, by virtue of growing up, you know, in a house where, you know, a house of people of color, I'm Black, my mom is Black, you know, and having my own experiences with law enforcement, I knew that police didn't operate in the most ethical way, and that there was corruption, but the fact that there were gangs was just something that always sort of drew me in. In any case, I would go to the library in my childhood and look for books about this stuff. I would try and like find news articles about it, but I never really was able to find anything substantial. It was always just sort of like a one-off type thing. So fast forward to summer of 2020, I was working at a local radio station in the LA area, and I was covering the uprisings that were happening related to the murder of George Floyd. And while I was doing that, I was actually shot with a less lethal munition by law enforcement, and the injuries resulting from that placed me on bed rest for a very long time, about like 6 months total. I wasn't really able to fully walk and function like I had normally had been able to. I didn't really feel like I could just sort of sit by and not work at that point, because of everything that was going on, you know, both in the world and in like my own newsroom. We were having very important conversations about race, and, you know, racism and how that affects the structures that we all live in. And I didn't want to sit back, basically. So I thought to myself, what's something that I can do that is, you know, going to provide value to this conversation and will be something that I can like really dig into? And I thought, okay, how about the sheriff's department? Just a couple of days after I was shot, a young man was actually killed by sheriff's deputies in the Compton area, an 18-year-old security guard by the name of Andres Guardado. He was shot by sheriff's deputies as he was on his knees attempting to get away from them in an alley. It was a really, really terrible shooting, and the case is still making its way through the courts. In any case, it came out pretty quickly that the deputies who killed Andres were actually chasing Inc. Or looking to become members of a deputy gang. And it was alleged that the way you get into the gangs is by killing someone. So when that came out, it pretty much confirmed for me that now was the time for me to start researching deputy gangs. And I spent those months on my couch looking into it, digging into it. And yeah, 6 months later, I came away with the series that is Tradition of Violence.
Google LASD gangs has become sort of a slogan that a lot of people recognize, but some might not know the wider context outside of the Los Angeles area. So just give us a general breakdown, kind of give us a crash course into this massive amount of work. And of course, we're going to link to your research, but I mean, it's, you know, very extensive, but just kind of give us an introduction to it.
Sure. So in my series, I was able to uncover at least 18 deputy gangs in the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. I've heard anecdotally about many, many more, but 18 I was able to pin down with some pretty solid evidence. It's really important to talk about why the word gang is used to describe these groups. For many years, the Sheriff's Department has been aware of the existence of gangs, but they, along with most media outlets, refuse to call them as such. And they will use terms like really meaningless terms like subgroup or terms that completely do not fully encapsulate what these gangs are doing, like clique, or fraternity or social group. They are gangs. The California Penal Code defines gangs as criminal enterprises with three or more people sharing a common hand sign, a tattoo, and participate in a long list of crimes under the California Penal Code. These sheriff's gangs fit that description perfectly. They have tattoos, they have hand signals that they use. They participate in crimes such as money laundering, blackmail, murder, rape. It really runs the gambit.
What are the origins of these gangs? Where do they come from?
The first gang that we know about inside of the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department was a gang called the Little Devils. They were discovered in the 1970s, just after the Chicano Moratorium, which was a protest of about 25,000 people in the East Los Angeles area, which is a high, very highly populated a Latinx area.
Massive riots.
Yeah, so basically what happened that day was the moratorium, it started out as a very peaceful gathering. This was something that, you know, people took their kids to. It was really a very, like, chill day. But that all changed when the sheriff's department arrived on the scene and they began beating people. And yeah, as you use the word riot, yeah, I would agree with that word when we're talking about what the sheriff's department did. I would say that the sheriff's department began rioting, assaulting people, and they even killed a couple of people, including a journalist that the night before had told his friends he suspected that he was being watched by the sheriff's department, and he actually feared that they would try to kill him that day. It was said that many of the deputies participating in this atrocious violent behavior were members of this gang called the Little Devils. They signified themselves by having a red devil tattoo on their leg, and the sheriff's department actually made a list of members of the Little Red Devils, but it's unclear if anyone was ever disciplined for belonging to that group, or participating in any of the violence that occurred during the Chicano moratorium. After the Little Red Devils, we saw many more gangs start to spring up, and that's sort of just by the virtue of how the department is organized and how these things work. So people generally that participate in these gangs are deputies that are participating in the most abuse, frankly. These are deputies that will really do whatever it takes to close a case or get an arrest, and that includes breaking the law. And generally, those people are also the same people that are promoted and given more responsibility inside the department. So new recruits and people coming in the department see that people that participate in all of these abuses and criminal activities are rewarded with promotions, pay bumps, and choice positions. That's how the gang culture is really encouraged. And as people continue to participate in it and get promoted, it continues that cycle.
So in your extensive research, one of the first gangs that really pops out is this group, the Vikings. Let's talk about them. Who are they, and how do they kind of come about?
Yes. So the Vikings is probably the, before my article, the Vikings were probably the most well-known gang inside the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. They were really at their height in the late 1980s, early 1990s, and they were functioning in the Linwood area. The Vikings was an explicitly white supremacist gang. They used a lot of Nazi imagery and ideology, but that doesn't mean their membership was all white. They actually had a number of POC employees that became official members with tattoos and everything, but the Viking tattoos for members of color, one of the horns of the Viking's hat was turned down, I guess, to signify that they weren't white. I'm not really sure what that's about. The Vikings were, I mean, really terrorists in the Linwood area for a number of years. They participated in raids without warrants, destroying people's houses. They would beat up people pretty regularly and just brutalize them completely without having any cause for arrest. Oftentimes, you know, not even arresting them at all, just sort of taking them into back alleys and completely mangling them. Eventually, the Linwood neighborhood came together under the leadership of a young man by the name of Lloyd Polk, and they told their stories to a group of attorneys that were willing to sue the sheriff's department for these abuses. At that time, a number of lawyers, most lawyers, I would say, in the Los Angeles area were really hesitant to sue the sheriff's department. It was something that wasn't really done in those days, but you can see now times have really changed. In any case, the neighbors came together, they told their stories, and they submitted a federal lawsuit that was eventually settled with a number of directives that really led to the Linwood station being closed. However, none of the deputies that were tattooed Vikings or were participating in these abuses ever faced any consequences or discipline for their actions. Basically, they were all transferred out and promoted. So again, you see this gang culture being reinforced as it's okay. This is how you rise through the department. We will take care of you and protect you. So after the transfer of those Vikings, again, you saw a number of new gangs starting to form at the stations where they had been placed. So in the Century Station, for example, you see a new gang coming up under the name regulators in the South Los Angeles area. You see the Spartans and the Grim Reapers, and now today groups like the Executioners.
Like, obviously the white supremacy is part and parcel to everything that we're talking about, but specifically, like, with the neo-Nazi imagery, do you feel like that was kind of a reflection on, like, what was happening in the prisons with, like, the rise of, like, the Aryan Brotherhood? Or was that, like, a decisive move on them, like a nod to, like, racist ideology? Or was it a mix of all of these things?
I've tended to believe that the embrace of Nazi imagery and ideology was really driven by who the department was recruiting. At that time, there were a number of recruit drives and efforts that were made in the South and the Midwest, and the department was very open about saying, like, look, we are looking for white men to come and join our force to police these, you know, black and brown people in, their words, the ghetto. So the LAPD, actually, their chief, Parker, who was chief from, I believe, the early 1940s through the 1960s, he would actually go to Ku Klux Klan rallies to recruit people. So this is a practice that was very, like, longstanding in law enforcement in Los Angeles County. And I think that that ideology is more just coming out of who they were bringing in rather than, you know, something happening in the jails. I think these were ideas that many, many people in among the ranks already had. And they were given the okay, sort of informally, by the sheriff's department to build criminal enterprises around those beliefs.
So in other words, it wasn't just like a couple, like, people that hung around, like, Hell's Angels that, like, wanted, like, tough imagery and, like, were racist, but they were also, like, selling speed and stuff and just kind of, like, in this outlaw culture. This was, like, people, like you said, that were from the Klan that, you know, were awash in this ideology.
Exactly.
Wow, that's incredible. So how did these gangs relate to other law enforcement, namely, like, the Los Angeles Police Department? And we're talking more, I guess, about the period around when the Vikings started. Like, how are they interacting with LAPD?
Generally speaking, the LAPD is responsible for policing the city of Los Angeles, and LA County is responsible for policing contract cities. That's places like Whittier, Compton, West Hollywood, as well as unincorporated Los Angeles County. So East Los Angeles, South Los Angeles, out in the Malibu area, and then to the north, areas like Lancaster, Palmdale, and the Antelope Valley, writ large. When it comes to interacting with LAPD, generally, I mean, technically, they don't really. I mean, unless you're talking about a task force or some sort of specialized strike team. But what I found is that the sheriff's department really doesn't respect jurisdictional boundaries. And they are more than happy to participate in criminal activity under the guise of law enforcement, not only in their jurisdiction, but others as well. One recent example of that I found is the shooting death of a young man by the name of Jamal Simpson. Jamal was followed by a sheriff's deputy by the name of Gregory Van Housen, who, out of policy, shot and killed a 16-year-old just 18 months prior to this incident that I am describing. He was never disciplined for the shooting death of the 16-year-old by the name of A.J. Weber. He was only transferred, again, the use of the transfer, you see, and allowed to remain on the force. In any case, so he's following Jamal Simpson. Jamal was a passenger in a car that never entered LASD jurisdiction. However, Deputy Van Housen continued to pursue Jamal, never gave a reason for pursuing the car. And when Jamal attempted to exit the car, Deputy Van Housen shot and killed him. The shooting was done inside LAPD territory, but sheriff's deputies and the sheriff's department retain control of that scene and that investigation, which is completely out of policy, but I'm finding that stuff like that happens more often than not.
Did whistleblowers or journalists have any impact attempting to investigate these groups as they began to proliferate throughout the sheriff's department?
Unfortunately, I think for the past 50 years, journalists and whistleblowers inside the department really haven't had any effect on how the department conducts itself. I think that my series has been like very instrumental in making this story very top of mind for people, not just in Los Angeles County, but across the United States. Unfortunately, the department has really just sort of doubled down in how it conducts itself. The sheriff has now forbidden employees of the sheriff's department from participating in meetings of the Civilian Oversight Commission, which is the independent body tasked with regulating the sheriff's department. The sheriff himself repeatedly has not responded to subpoenas. The information is out there, but the sheriff's department, their mode of response is really just to circle their wagons, close ranks, and continue business as usual.
What impact have these gangs within the sheriff's department had in the local jail system?
LASD gangs in the jail system have made the process of incarceration even more dangerous and atrocious than it already is. For many, many years, the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department has been hesitant, is a little bit more polite of a word than I would like, to let press into the jails. To my knowledge, I do not know of any journalist that has been able to enter Men's Central Jail, which is the primary jail housing facility here in the county, in the past 5 years. The abuse that happens in the jails is rampant, and I suspect that is probably why press haven't been allowed in. I've heard anecdotes about graffiti describing incarcerated people as animals. I've heard of drawings inside the jails that are sort of like racist caricatures of incarcerated people. I've heard numerous reports of brutal beating assaults. I've heard stories of people that are raped in the jails, and I've heard numerous stories of people that have been beaten to death inside the jails. And all of this, again, is happening in a place that is really free from outside observers. It's really awful. I mean, I suspect that what I've been able to uncover about the jails and what groups like the ACLU were able to uncover about the jails back in the early 2010s was really just scratching the surface of everything that was happening in there.
I'm going to switch gears here a little bit. Tell us about the Jump Out Boys. Who are they and why are they important to the story?
Yeah, the Jump Out Boys were a deputy gang that was actually discovered by the sheriff's department itself. One of the founders of this gang left a memo of the gang's creed, I guess you could call it, sort of the rules and regulations of being a gang member. This was left in the trunk of a department vehicle and discovered by the gang leader's boss. An investigation was carried out. A number of people were questioned about the Jump Out Boys. However, only 7 people that were investigated were eventually disciplined for it. The 7 members were fired and given hearings, which is a right that is given to county employees here in LA County. They are allowed to appeal any firing to the Civil Service Commission. The Civil Service Commission actually found that the Jump Out Boys had been discriminated against, and they were rehired, a number of them, and they were also awarded back pay to the tune of about $500,000 each. So again, this is really just telling you that the county really doesn't have any vested interest in getting rid of these gangs that routinely abuse and kill citizens. In fact, sometimes they even protect them.
You know, we already talked about the Vikings and their racist undertones. How did that influence persist, and what does that look like today?
So one thing I was talking about earlier was the fact that the Vikings, while they were a white supremacist neo-Nazi group, they did have a number of members of color. And as the Sheriff's Department has diversified over the years, the Sheriff's Department today, as it stands, is now mostly a Latino organization, Latino being primarily men coming from Central America, of Central American descent. The mentality that upholds white supremacy and upholds the importance of brotherhood in blue, this idea, this notion of an identity based around employment, has persisted. Today, I would say that members of these deputy gangs see, and not just members of deputy gangs, I mean, this is like police, like writ large, they see other police officers as the people that they have to protect above all else, not citizens of the jurisdictions that they're sworn to serve and protect, but their colleagues. And holding up colleagues above all other people, you see, again, reinforcement of white supremacist ideals, because they tend to go hand in hand. So, I mean, today we have groups like the Bandidos in the East Los Angeles Station. That's a primarily Latino gang of deputies. They target Black people, and they target other Latinos, generally people that, you know, may be a recent arrival to this country, maybe are here, you know, without a visa or without a green card. Those are the people they target. And again, it's upholding sort of white supremacist ideals, like, you know, you don't belong here, that sort of thing. And when you look at the South Los Angeles district, where we see a lot more gangs targeting Black people, you'll see that happening by, you know, other deputies of color. You'll see Latino deputies targeting Black people, which, again, is a vestige of white supremacy.
Yeah, we had the abolitionist Alex Vital on here not that long ago, and one of the things that he was talking about was that even when departments, you know, quote, diversify and hire more officers of color, that, you know, like rates of police brutality and killing really aren't affected, as you still have basically the same system in place. And, you know, one of the things that just popped into my head as we were talking about this stuff, how does this relate to ICE? Because, I mean, the Sheriff's Department, in my understanding, is working obviously with ICE and also like checking people at the, jails for their immigration status, and sometimes handing people over to immigration. Do you know anything about their relationship with ICE at all?
I've heard anecdotally about several instances where the Sheriff's Department has collaborated with ICE, despite the fact that our current sheriff, Alex Villanueva, likes to tout that he doesn't collaborate with ICE. That's not what I've heard anecdotally. I've heard of several people that came into contact with sheriff's deputies who were later deported, which is, again, something that the sheriff says isn't happening, but I know of several cases where it has.
You're listening to It's Going Down, part of the Channel Zero Anarchist Podcast Network. Follow us online at itsgoingdown.org and on Twitter at IGD_news. If you like and appreciate this podcast, go to itsgoingdown.org/shop and give us a one-time donation. Sign up to donate monthly or donate through Bitcoin. Again, that's itsgoingdown.org/shop to support. And now, back to the show.
Over this past year, we saw this explosion in the streets after the police murder of George Floyd. I'm curious, you know, how have these gangs within the department interacted with or repressed or kind of like been impacted by in any way at all that you've seen by this wave of black-led rebellion in the streets?
They hate it.
Okay.
I mean, every day I see deputy gang members and associates posting really awful, derogatory, racist memes and commentary on their social media accounts. One law enforcement-owned clothing brand recently released a t-shirt celebrating Kyle Rittenhouse's acquittal. I see stickers that make jokes about the arrest of activists and protesters that are uplifting Black Lives Matter. I have seen jokes made about people running over activists with cars, jokes made by deputies inside of the sheriff's department. Overall, I would say that they harbor a great deal of violence for people that support the notion that Black life is sacred and needs to be protected. It's something that they have a lot of open animosity about. One common thing that I see posted is an image of a cartoon image of sheriff's deputies like running over protesters whenever something involving Black Lives Matter sort of makes its way into the news cycle. And the department is aware of this stuff because I routinely ask them about it, but it's not something that they appear to be interested in tapping down on or inquiring with their deputies about. And it's not just limited to Black Lives Matter. I mean, I see deputies all the time, posting things that are, they're really posting like hate about gay people, about other people of color. I mean, anyone that isn't like white, essentially, anyone is a target for these deputies on social media. And I expect that you see that animosity play out in arrest statistics, in who is being brutalized by the department and who is being shot and killed.
You brought up social media. I'm curious if we could talk a little bit about that. Is that something that's accelerating this? I know there's been several kind of like investigations into like secret law enforcement, like far right pages, where they're sharing kind of like reactionary and racist memes and stuff like that. Do these gangs like have presence like on social media themselves? Or is that like a hub of where a lot of this stuff is taking place? Or is this just kind of a reflection of some of these attitudes?
I would say it's more of a reflection of the attitudes and the activities that they're already engaging in. I haven't found a Bandidos fan club page yet. But what I do see a lot of is deputy gang members and associates posting logos associated with the gang, posting paraphernalia associated with the gang, like custom woodwork decorations of their gang's logo, wallets with the gang logo etched on it, things like that. Maybe like pictures or blankets with the gang's logo, decorative furniture with the gang's logo, flags, mouse pads, computer cases with gang's logo, stuff like that. You'll see a lot of that on social media.
So let's talk about two more recent gangs. In your writings, you mentioned both the Bandidos and one we've already talked a little bit about, the Executioners. Tell us about these two more recent additions to this long list.
Yeah, so the Executioners are a gang that operates out of the Compton Station. There are several lawsuits pending in the Superior Court where several whistleblowers have come forward to talk about the antics of the gang. It's been alleged that they do not allow women to join, that they do not allow Black people to join, and that they essentially run the station. They determine who gets what assignments, who is working what shift, when vacation days will be approved, that sort of thing. To get into the Executioners, it's alleged that you need to kill a civilian. And upon killing the civilian, you will have a 998 party. 998 is the code for deputy-involved shooting. And at these 998 parties, you receive your Executioner tattoo. The tattoo is of a skeleton holding an assault rifle wearing a Nazi helmet. The Bandidos aren't too different. They are out of the East Los Angeles station. As I mentioned, they are primarily a Latino gang. They do not allow women to join. However, women are allowed to be associates of the gang. And it's been alleged that in order to become an associate of the gang, if you are a woman, you have to perform sexual favors for members of the gang. And again, they essentially run the East Los Angeles station, just like the way the Compton Executioners are running the station in Compton.
Cut to eat their heads already, fed and sweaty, sweaty, studi chefs, I'm Eddie. Svart skin som alkaline, svar på tal och ber jag alltid tajt. Shell kriminell utan påföljde, sex timmar cell, Bruno K röjer. Men de kallar mig meat for meat, på en strikt diet av veganer och leafy greens. Och Jens fuckar med svart lax, nere i gruvan där vi gräver nattpass efter nattpass. Ingen aning om det är dagsljus eller natt. Svart ute bland folk för vi har fastnat, men slipper genom kontroll för vi har fattat. Livet en kod som vi har hackat, lite arrogant men framförallt tacksam. Jag lever i ett livshack, tills den dagen som de lägger mig i kistan. De skjuter men de missar, för jag vägrar reduceras till en siffra. Yeah, jag mer flyter än en bankir. Och min flyt är min framtid. Yeah, vill du ha flyt får du byta din taktik och byta din handstil. Vi flyter för antik. Jag kan inte tro dem är redo för dessa sweeties. Vi får MCs och push up daisies tills jag pushar Mercedes. Vill ha det materiella men jag stuck in the matrix. Men det är samma gata nu, jag ser BSOP. The G's tjänar mer än mitt knäck plus OB. The life hack, inte som Anonymous eller en iMac. Direkt en annan effekt, det här är för din baslåda. För när du snurrar din rap, cirkulerar, tänker fritt och avkodar. Tänk snabbt som Mach 3, the unreal, huh. Släng upp en hand för din stadsdel. Styrsonen, jag byfånen. Jag tyfånen på beat och jag flyt på den. För att jag bryter koden sen hittar min rhythm med livet så att du inte ser Kim slipping. Brått om till Stockholm, så dödar den på femman i Volvo. MCs kör om dem, saltar på svart lax, spottar och antrax. Tacksam som fan. Jag lever i ett livshack, tills den dagen som de lägger mig i kistan. De skjuter men de missar, för jag vägrar reduceras till en siffra. Jag lever i ett livshack, tills den dagen som de lägger mig i kistan. De skjuter men de missar, för jag vägrar reduceras till en siffra. Måste ducka skitsnack, vara si och så, springa runt i cirklar skitsnack. Men vårt liv kan bli ett livshack, knäcker koderna tillsammans kan vi hitta. Titta! Alltid vara ärlig med mitt liv, mitt inre kommer vägleda mig dit. Allt annat ska jag vägra ge min tid, popularitetstävlingar och skit. Sagorna som stjäl min energi, systemet alltid varit min enemy. Fuck din enda väg, jag går bredvid.
Jag lever i ett livspack tills den dagen som de lägger mig i kistan. De skjuter men de missar, för jag vägrar reduceras till en siffra. Jag lever i ett livspack tills den dagen som de lägger mig i kistan. De skjuter men de missar, för jag vägrar reduceras till en siffra.
You know, you've written all this stuff. You know, there's videos online of like activists disrupting meetings, screaming they Google LSD gangs. There's graffiti everywhere. I mean, this has become a common slogan. It goes viral online. How have they responded to all this stuff?
I mean, not well. It's the response that I have received has been threats. When the series first published, I received a number of death threats via social media, text message, phone call. I was detained at a press conference after I was spotted by one of the deputy gang associates I wrote about. She sent a couple of goons in uniform to detain me and attempt to arrest me. I recently found out that the sheriff's department has enlisted a team of crime analysts to monitor my social media for what they called potential doxing purposes. I've been threatened by the campaign manager of the current sheriff, who threatened to post my personal address online. The sheriff routinely tells people to sue me. I haven't been sued yet. And that is because my series was very robustly fact-checked, and there really aren't any grounds to sue me on. But I mean, in a nutshell, the response has been to threaten me and to try and silence me via threat.
Well, I'm sorry you're going through all that. That's a lot. Well, just kind of stepping back, I mean, what do you think this says about policing in general? I mean, specifically in the Los Angeles area. Listening to you talking about this, is there a component of, like, organized criminal activity? I mean, beyond, like, you know, killing people and creating a culture of brutality?
I would say that a lot of this gang activity is done to sort of, like, I guess it's sort of, like, done as a means of like justifying the department's existence and used as a means to justify a larger police budget. When you look at the activities that they are involved in, I mean, it's crime, right? I mean, it's essentially just the commission of crime. And then they go on and say, well, like, we need more resources so we can tackle this crime. And that's how you end up with a $3 billion budget for a department. And I don't think that that is unique to L.A. County. I think, you know, I have heard from people across the United States that have shared with me about gangs in their local jurisdictions. And this isn't just civilians. These are sometimes actual law enforcement officers calling me up and saying, look, Cerise, we've got a gang here. And I don't know what to do about it. I don't know how I can get rid of it because it's coming from the top down. So I don't think this is a Los Angeles problem. I think this is a problem that is, you know, a product of the system of policing that we have in this country.
So what happens next in all this stuff? I mean, now that it becomes exposed and goes out into the open, I'm curious, you know, where you think it can go from here?
Well,
if you have all this evidence and then the police's response is basically like, we're going to get you. I mean, it's all kind of there. So I guess what happens now?
Well, we do have a election coming up in 2022 for sheriff in LA County. And I expect the voters will oust Villanueva. He's sort of become the face of many of these problems, so I do not expect him to be reelected. However, I know that that won't end these problems. I mean, these problems were in the department before Villanueva, and they will persist after he's gone. I hope that the community continues to be engaged about these issues and continues to work to really dismantle these issues. And I think, you know, personally speaking, in order to fully dismantle these issues, that would mean dismantling the sheriff's department. It's been 50 years of continued abuses of our community, and I don't see how you could fix it. You know, I used to work on the radio. If I made one mistake, it was okay. But if I made two mistakes, that was going to lead to some serious discipline and or firing. We've had 50 years of consistent mistakes every day, hour after hour, minute after minute by the sheriff's department, which has had very real consequences in the loss of life, permanent physical and mental damage to thousands of people. I don't think we can go on like this anymore.
Tell people how they can follow you and check out more of your work.
Yes. Please follow me on social media. You can find me at Cerise Castle. I try to do a story about the sheriff's department every week. I recently had a story out about a whistleblower who was fired after attempting to alert the sheriff's department to criminal conduct inside of his station. As you mentioned at the top, there really isn't a shortage of abuses going on inside the sheriff's department. So if you would like to learn more, I have plenty of stories that are constantly coming out.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.